Good evening. James McKenna here with my Science Hour for September 20th, 2018. Many topics to cover tonight, and just not really political, but get out and vote in the November elections. Numbers count because there is going to be unprecedented cheating, and this is something I brought up. Most of this is done at the local level. So if you can somehow in your local precinct, I guess infiltrate it would be the best term, to watch, simply observe so that cheating cannot take place. What happens, we found out during the 2016 presidential election, is that what is one of the biggest areas of fraud. And I can even tell you where it happens: Las Vegas, Denver, Colorado. So Las Vegas, Nevada, Los Angeles, San Francisco, the Bay Area, Portland and Seattle area, Minneapolis, and Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania were big centers for cheating. Chicago, oh my goodness. And other locations like the southeastern Florida, Dade County was a big cheating area. And by the way, also I made a statement that Hurricane Florence was not an accident. It was not due to warm water. The devastation there, I believe, is just the beginning. I predicted that there will be a hurricane closer to election time in southeastern Florida. And that's the Debbie Wasserman Schultz election. She is going to have a very tough time winning her seat back in for the Democratic Party, the Senate seat. And she has a contender that is, I think, going to win unless they can throw a curve in there like a hurricane. And so I actually predicted that it's the only method they have, apparently, to pull out all the stops. Also, on that same vein, the FBI, as probably many of you have seen in the news, raided the National Solar Observatory, which is in New Mexico, remote area of New Mexico. And unbeknownst to anybody, without announcing to the local sheriff, basically evacuated the whole location plus the U.S. Post Office, which was on the site. And so there's been a lot of speculation about that. But the one thing I can tell you is that the reason that they gave, the public reason for the FBI shutting that facility down, did not make any sense. They said there was a public danger there, there was some imminent threat, and that was for the public safety of the workers, etc. And then all of a sudden, when there was a lot of notoriety building over this, then all of a sudden it was like, oh, well, I guess there's no problem. Everybody go back to work. So, apparently the local sheriff was a bit perturbed because he was not informed. He was not kept in the loop, which is actually illegal. The sheriff has control of his locale. Okay, so anyway, my estimate was that they were getting ready, and this is once again, we're bearing down on the election here, and to cause chaos, basically, because in the shadow of chaos, they can basically throw elections. So that's what my estimate was, that there would be a false flag, solar flare, and I've been talking about this for years, that this will be one of the big rabbits to be pulled out of a hat and in a time of crisis. And clearly right now is a time of crisis for the deep state. This election is critical. And if the Democrats cannot pull this off, I have said before, this will change politics for the next 30 years. It could be the end of the Democratic Party as we know it. So it'll be very interesting to see how this shakes out. But a lot of money is being poured into Texas. If you're in Texas, then go out. Ted Cruz is the Republican, and I'm not particularly a Republican, but with Trump at the helm and basically doing many good things for the United States, and really in the area of science, Trump is not doing a good job. But I have to look at the total picture. And so if I were really partisan, if I were selfish, if I were about me, I would say, well, Trump is not recognizing my science and good science. He's going with all the government baloney. And then, you know, that could potentially put me against him because science is my area. But I realize that, you know, for the overall good of this country, Trump is doing a very good job. So not with my particular corner of the planet and science, but in general. And maybe it'll take more time to get rid of the all of the politicization of science. But at any rate, I am for Republicans. Now, a lot of Republicans are dropping out because they're the old school. There's a lot of new people coming in who are Trump supporters that are going to move with the Trump agenda. And that's been part of the problem, is that he has not had a supportive Congress. Okay, so enough of that. But get out and vote, become active, and do exit polls. That's an excellent way to find out, count the number of people that went in and voted, and then also compare the exit polls, who they voted for, with the actual count as a way of one method of verifying the vote. Okay, so enough of that, but very, very important. And just once again, I'm expecting in key areas, especially California, in Texas, in southeastern Florida, Dade County, and other locations. And I will repeat that Hurricane Florence was no accident to completely disrupt the elections in that area. Okay, and in that whole part of the country, there's been a lot of disruption due to flooding. And some of that will recover before the election, but a lot of it will not. And those are the types of conditions where there can be massive cheating and very difficult to tell. Okay. Now, there's a... let me just first talk about this. Elon Musk. I like Elon Musk. I don't know him personally, obviously. But I like a lot of the things he does. I think he's kind of a kid with a lot of money and acts like a kid. But that's good. I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying, like when the Falcon Heavy went off, him running outside, looking at it going up, it reminded me, as I helped kids one time with a rocket project, and watching the look on those little kids' faces as their rocket went up into the sky. And it was the same look that Elon Musk had when watching that. You know, just the look of amazement, just totally looking at that. Of course, that was a big toy rocket. So, but anyway, he has just sold the first seat on a moon rocket for 2023 to a billionaire Japanese guy. And so anyway, he's starting to sell seats to go and orbit around the moon, not land on the moon, just orbit the moon and come back. But I would suggest that they at least send a mouse first, or, you know, I don't know, some other kind of, I don't know if you call them disposable animal, but some kind of living little being in a spaceship, go through the Van Allen belts and encounter the radiation that's between here and the moon, the solar radiation, etc., because instead of just like sending people there. And the other issue is maybe try it a few times first to make sure you have your logistics down, because a little error there and those people could be blasting off into space never to return. So anyway, that's their deal. You won't find me buying a seat. Of course, I'm not a billionaire, don't have the money. If I did, I wouldn't be buying a seat there. But also, there's been a rash. I guess that's the best term I can say, like a rash, a bad rash, where you can't, I won't make any comments, but there's been a bad rash of bad movies about space. And a new one just came out. Somebody sent me the link here with Sean Penn. I don't even know the name of it. It's on like one of the private movie channels, to go to Mars and all of the. And now this is a term that was coined by a friend of mine. And I like it, so I'm going to repeat it, and I would suggest that you start repeating it when you talk about these kind of movies. They're rah-rah, they have sentiment and family, the Armageddon type of plot where the emotion, the girlfriend or the wife or the kid is like, well, gee, Dad, are you going to come home? You know, and it's Dad is out to save the universe. But this one is with Sean Penn, and it's got what we call space emotion porn. And so it's a lot of drippy, thick honey, molasses, sweet, basically the term, I like that term, space emotion porn, because it's a way of trying to drum up emotion for the watching audience regarding outer space. And of course it's always NASA and etc. as a way of creating support for the space program. And this goes way back. When I was a little kid, there were movies that were, you know, taking place down in Cape Canaveral, and to drum up support, let's put it that way, for the National Space Program. Which, by the way, is not the real space program. It's the rah-rah, zizboomba NASA space program that's visible. The real space program is not visible. You don't see it. Okay, so anyway, Elon Musk is selling tickets. Anybody out there has got $1 billion, you can have a ride to the moon. You can be one of the first people to actually encounter the Van Allen belts. And anyway, well, good luck, everybody, if you want to do that. Okay, just a note on anonymity, letters, commentary, etc. I have been victim of anonymity criticism for all my life, basically, all my scientific life. And if you look in, I'm not even going to go through it, all of the places, but now we're seeing more and more anonymous letters, anonymous statements in the newspaper. And this last one actually was anonymous regarding Brett Kavanaugh, Supreme Court nominee. And it was anonymous. And then all of a sudden, the only person that knew who this was Senator Feinstein. And obviously she leaked the name to the press, because this woman who wanted to remain anonymous, and of course this has gone through a whole political turmoil since the release of her name, but the name was released, obviously, by Dianne Feinstein, and the ranking Democratic senator, because the anonymous ploy wasn't getting traction, and they wanted to derail Kavanaugh from being nominated and voted into the Supreme Court. Because he's a young guy, he's going to be there for the next 30 years minimum. And so anyway, the idea, however, of putting anonymous accusations, anonymous criticisms, anonymous anything, there, you know, a guy saying, oh, they have information that the White House, there's total chaos, and everybody thinks that every day is going to be the end of the world. And the people who work in the White House are going, this is ridiculous. That's not the way it is. So, but the ability to take an anonymous criticism and blow it up and keep repeating it is really a danger, because in this country, you have the right to face your accusers. When it's anonymous, there's no ability to face your accusers. like on the internet, when people criticize me or when people like at YouTube block my content. And by the way, I have a real.video channel now. I'll be hopefully within the next month putting some content on there and having more video activity. But I never posted on YouTube because all of my work was blocked. And but anyway, once again, that's a form of anonymous censorship, anonymous criticism. There are some web pages that criticize my work, and they always they repeat. They say, "Don't buy his books." They even claim that they haven't read my books, and yet they're trying to criticize me and say he's wrong about this. He's, you know, and they haven't even read my books. It's ridiculous. But anonymity, and then the people don't sign their names. And of course, like Wikipedia is the same. Censorship without anybody putting their name on it. So these people can sit back, armchair quarterback, on Wikipedia, which is a terrible, terrible reference. Wikipedia has been completely taken over and dominated. Unfortunately, that's what kids use, probably the first thing they go to. If they have to study something, they probably go to Wikipedia, believing they're getting real information when it's just garbage. So anyway, anonymity is being used as a tool by people who create fake news. And then anonymous source, as if an anonymous source is somehow legitimate. And also, there was a time back in the Planet X days when people would go, "Oh, it was a Russian source," as if they had some kind of inside scoop from Russian scientists. Well, that wasn't true at all. They just were making it up. I had real contact with real Russian scientists, but a lot of the internet garbage related to Planet X and all of the phony baloney stories dealing with Planet X, they, you know, a lot of times would throw that out. Oh, due to Russian contact, when they didn't have any Russian contacts at all. Okay, well, enough of that, but just be aware of that. When you see anonymous, it's like, no. Like when I come on the radio show, it's my name. I have my name on it. If you agree or you disagree, whatever, I'm putting my name on what I talk about. You can listen to it, and you can agree or disagree. But the end result is that I don't believe in anonymity. Okay, enough of that. The main science topic I want to talk about tonight is a comet called K2. Now, this is an important event that's going to take place in the next, actually around 2023 is when I believe it's closest approach. No, it's August of 2022. Well, and then through the next number of months after that, August 29th, it crosses the ecliptic according to its current orbit. But that's going to change. This is a comet that was the most distant comet ever discovered. The official name is C-2017 K2 Pan-STARRS. And so just to tell you what that means, C is for comet. 2017 is the year it was discovered. K2 is the designation, so I just kind of will abbreviate it as comet K2. And then Pan-STARRS is the observing program that discovered it. It's an automated observing program for deep space objects. Okay, so I've been tracking this object for a while, and I just said I would keep everybody updated on this. So, okay, let me talk about the orbit a little bit. It's interesting because Hale-Bopp came in from the southern region of the solar system. And this comet is coming in from the northern region of the solar system. It's not clear if this object has been here before. The orbits that are given for this comet indicate that it has not, that it's the first time for this comet to visit our solar system. But I never quite believe those that data. I never quite believe it. But at any rate, the end result is that this comet is going to come into the solar system from the north. In other words, if you looked off of our North Pole, or the northern hemisphere, basically, in the night sky, you would be able to, if you had good telescope equipment right now, you would be able to see it. So even though they say this was discovered beyond the orbit of Saturn, it is not coming in from the plane of the planets. That's just a distance reference. So this is coming in from the north. Now it's coming down and well outside the orbit of Mars. Then it dips down far below the sun, far below the solar system, and then comes back up through the ecliptic, which is the plane of the planets, basically the plane of Earth's orbit, which we use for a reference, and most of the planets are somewhat close to that plane. They're not all aligned. It's not like they're all exactly in a plane. But this object will pass down way below the sun and then come back up through the ecliptic or plane of the planets, again, far outside the orbit of Mars. So when you look at this, it will probably be a fairly large comet. And it'll probably be visible in the sky, relatively visible with the naked eye. But remember, it's quite a ways away. When Hale-Bopp came through the solar system, it came from the southern region of the solar system and crossed the ecliptic, the plane of the planets, right about at Earth's orbit. But Earth had moved on 3 months in its orbit. I've talked about this before. And it missed us. It was originally on a very close collision course with Earth when it was first discovered in 1989 and to 1991 by Robert Harrington of the Naval Observatory under a contract from NASA, which read Search for Planet X. That was the name of the NASA contract with the Naval Observatory. But this comet was discovered by an automated search and coming in from the north. Now, if you analyze, which I did, this comet coming in, according to its current orbital parameters, in other words, what's known as the ephemeris, that's a Latin term, but basically this is the table of orbital dynamical elements that would predict where it's going to be at a given time. So according to the current prediction based on its current orbit, August 29th in the year 2022, it crosses the ecliptic. But what's very interesting is it has a very near electrical alignment with the planet Mercury. Okay, so that's fairly interesting. However, the comet K2 is going to be well beyond the orbit of Mars. We don't know how big it is. NASA is already putting disinformation out that it's this little icy snowball wanderer, and it's little and teeny, and you don't have to worry about it. But the reality is that it is way out there beyond Mars' orbit. And even if it loses energy, which it's going to, it's a big comet. The bigger comets lose much more energy than the small comets. Their orbits become circularized. But from what we learned about Hale-Bopp, Hale-Bopp only started to change its orbit once it got inside the orbit of about Jupiter, or near the orbit of Jupiter. And that's when it really exploded into brightness. That's when it was discovered. And that's when its orbit started to change rapidly on a daily basis. And slow down, etc. So it's hard to say. This comet is much farther out than Hale-Bopp when Hale-Bopp was officially discovered. This comet K2 probably would have been discovered by amateurs given enough time, but these automated search computerized search with big telescopes are so conclusive that they're finding most of the comets now, not amateurs. Remember that they say, for example, Schumacher Levy 9 was the ninth comet discovered by Schumacher and Levy. They discovered many comets together. So, but now most of the comet discoveries are being done by automated search engines, as was this one. Okay, so when this encounter occurs on August 29th of 2022, if the orbit of K2 stays the same, which I don't think it will, then even that would be a very distant interaction. Venus, Earth, and Mars are nowhere to be found. They're in a very different part of the solar system when this crossing of the ecliptic plane occurs. But as it moves down below the sun and then outbound on its orbit, something very interesting happens in the following. Two things happen with tail drag. The orbit gets closer to the sun, and that's called energy loss or energy dumping. And and also it slows down. That's the tail drag. There's eccentricity dampening and orbital circularization are other terms. But oddly, what's happening there is there on its outbound path, it's going to pass relatively close to Jupiter. But if it slows down significantly and its orbit drops in closer to the sun, in and around the 1st of April on 2025, this comet could have a very close encounter with Jupiter, which would mean we would be able to see the kind of electrical interactions that the ancients talked about. Remember when Jupiter captured Venus, it was something that was recorded indelibly in the mythology of the Babylonians, which was passed down to the Greeks, which was passed down to the Romans, when Venus was born of Zeus. Remember that Zeus was the father of Venus. And so what I understand now, Velikovsky, remember, talked about Venus popping out of Jupiter. And, of course, he didn't understand physics. He didn't understand celestial mechanics. And everybody criticized him for that. And it was one of his mistakes, trying to interpret scientifically what the ancients were talking about. And now it's very clear, because of my work, that the comet Venus was captured by Jupiter. And prior to that, nobody noticed it. When it interacted with Jupiter, it exploded into brightness and became this massive comet, and also was captured into the plane of the planets and started circling inwards. And Venus, the comet, Quetzalcoatl, as the Mayas talked about it, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, and remember it interacted with Mars, took the oceans and atmosphere off of Mars. But when this happens, if it happens, that is, in the time frame of April 2025, this comet could have its orbit changed significantly and have a major electrical interaction with Jupiter. So we would see, standing here on Earth, we would be able to see, and let me just also discuss where Earth is going to be at this time. Earth will be... Let me give you the relative position of Jupiter with respect to Earth. Jupiter will be in the evening sky. So you would look up at around sundown, and Jupiter would be relatively high in the sky at that point, but then it would set in the west. And this would continue in through May and in through June. So during that time period, and if it were even earlier, if it were like before April, if it were like in March, then it would be much higher in the sky. And of course, we always have to compete with full moons and lunar cycles. But it would be close enough, and potentially this comet would be large enough that we could see it interacting with Jupiter electrically, confirming basically what the ancients said, that and what Velikovsky said, how he interpreted the ancient texts talking about the, for example, Zeus, as I've always said, Zeus throwing lightning bolts across the solar system. And remember that Earth has encountered Jupiter, electron streams from Jupiter. The military has measured these with satellites, wondering where this electron stream came from, and identified it with Jupiter. So, at any rate, this is a very important set of events that are coming up, and I'll just keep tracking it. What's important right now is to follow the orbit, because the ephemeris has been published. It's been determined through extensive measurements that are based on positions of this comet and then the gravitational field of mainly the sun and other the planets, especially the bigger planets, Jupiter, etc. But mainly it's in orbit around the sun. But as the tail drag changes its orbit, the ephemeris will change. And we saw that with Hale-Bopp. The ephemeris was changing on a daily basis. And Brian Marsden, who is the curator of the Smithsonian for data relating to comets and asteroids, near-Earth objects, etc., NEOs they're called, all of this data is kept at the Smithsonian. And when Hale-Bopp was first discovered, they said, well, this is really big. They knew it was big, but they lied about it. They said, oh, it was 42 miles across. Well, no, Hale-Bopp was planetary size. And it was building up on a daily basis, pulling in tremendous amounts of matter, and that changed its orbit considerably, which meant that the ephemeris was actually changing on a daily basis, something that's really almost unheard of. So, at any rate, it's going to be very interesting to watch this. It's very interesting to watch the changes of the orbit of this object, K2. And that's something I'll keep track of. And by the way, I've already seen shifts in data. There are a number of sites that list the parameters for this orbit, and they've already begun to change, which tells me that the tail drag is already influencing this object. So is it big? Obviously it's big. And how big? Is it Earth or planetary size? Is it the size of Pluto? Is it the size of Charon, Pluto's moon? Is it smaller? Is it larger? We really don't know. And of course, I'll just tell you a little trick here, that with the, for example, radio telescope at Arecibo, Puerto Rico, or any of the other radio telescopes that are used for radio astronomy, or the VLA, the Very Large Array in New Mexico, etc., they can pinpoint the exact size of the nucleus using radio waves, but they don't do that. They did not do that with Hale-Bopp, and they're clearly not doing it with this comet, which is very big. Now, I've seen some videos, people have sent me links, and NASA is already out on YouTube thumping the idea that this is a, oh, they just can't say little icy wanderer and snowball and snowy little, oh, just cannot say it enough times. Just pounding that into the poor public's heads, so there can't be any room for any other thought regarding comets. So anyway, this is a very interesting comet. I'll be keeping you updated on this, as well as any other new occurrences. But let me just repeat that this is not, there's no indication, even if this orbit changes by a lot, there's no indication that this would have any major effect on planet Earth. Just let me make that perfectly clear, that there is not an issue here with planet Earth, actually even any of the other planets. I think if it interacted with Jupiter, it'd be very interesting. And remember, this is another point to make clear right now, is that in the vicinity of Jupiter, there's a lot of sulfur dioxide. That's why Jupiter is kind of that reddish color. And so we've seen this before where, in fact, Schumacher Levy 9, this is the comet that broke into 21 pieces and came into Jupiter and crashed 21 pieces into the dark side of Jupiter. And as these pieces started approaching Jupiter, they magically changed from water comets to sulfur dioxide comets. And that's, if you look at the cover photo of my book, Comets, it has a picture of the 21 pieces coming in to the realm of Jupiter. And, of course, the dirty snowball comet model, it's absurd. How could they all, when they come in, cross this magical line, turn into sulfur dioxide comets? Well, and not have any water at all, because that's the main chemical component. Now, remember, also when that was happening, that was in around 1995, the Schumacher-Levy 9 crashing into Jupiter, was the same time that Russian scientists were translating my work, becoming familiar with it. The dialogues are in the appendices of my weather book, some of the interactions between myself and the Russians. But they said categorically that so many things happened there, that the comets turned from water comets into sulfur dioxide comets. No time in history of cometary science have comets been sulfur dioxide comets. That's a species that's very characteristic of the orbit of Jupiter. And so let me just explain why this is briefly. I explain this in my books. But the solar wind acts something like a centrifuge. And as you get closer to the sun, the heavy elements like iron and nickel, etc., dominate the basically outer space. And as you get out farther around Earth, in fact, water and hydrogen oxygen compounds dominate around Earth. When you get out to Jupiter, it's the sulfur compounds, sulfur dioxide primarily. When you get out towards Saturn, then you start getting lighter elements yet, which is primarily hydrogen. When you get out towards Neptune, you get the nitrogen hydrogen compounds, which are lighter yet, like ammonia, etc. And so then when you get out towards Pluto, you also get the nitrogen hydrogen compounds. And that's common out into the nebular ion cloud, which is beyond. So the end result is that there's a differentiation occurring in the solar system with the chemical species, and around Jupiter it's sulfur dioxide. So the idea that somehow comets would magically turn into, if the dirty snowball comet model, looking at that, how could they all of a sudden know that as they get close to Jupiter they should all turn into sulfur dioxide comets? Well, it's ridiculous. What it proves is that the tail material is being drawn into the nucleus from the locally available species. And so that's one issue. And then also, when these 21 pieces crashed in to the far side of Jupiter, NASA claimed, there's nothing to see. They're just little ice balls. They'll just penetrate into the atmosphere of Jupiter. And by the time Jupiter turns around so that we can see it, there won't be anything to see. But what they saw were 21 rings. They looked like donuts, sulfur dioxide donuts. So when the comet tail came in, it made a ring type of a shape in the upper atmosphere of Jupiter. And that's the same type of pattern we see on planet Earth when water comets come in, and literally it's the tail of the comet which spreads out over a vast area of the upper atmosphere. And that's what Lou Frank was seeing, as the small water comets would come in, and is basically the tail or the connections. The other thing, even we, you don't even need a comet nucleus to come in, because Earth's upper atmosphere is acting like charge centers and drawing water vapor in, just like a comet. So we are constantly drawing in water from outer space. And you can actually see this in the satellite data. Okay, so at any rate, getting back to Jupiter and Comet K2, what we will probably see is Comet K2, as it gets into that realm around Jupiter, we're going to start to see it developing characteristics of sulfur dioxide. And if it gets close enough to Jupiter, they're going to interact, and it'll be a very interesting interaction, because Jupiter, what happened with Venus is Jupiter has a fairly significant discharge of the solar capacitor, so it could very much enhance this comet as it becomes electrically aligned with Jupiter, which is very interesting. But once again, Earth is not in this time frame of April 1st, 2025. Earth is not in any type of alignment with Jupiter or the position where this comet is. But all of that can change because the orbit of K2 might change. So Earth might be in a completely different region of its orbit. Jupiter may be in a completely different region of its orbit, and all the other planets also. So it would be interesting to see if there were any double planetary alignments, for example. For example, we've seen in the past where, remember Comet Lee in 1999 had this amazing planetary lunar new moon passing alignment. And even though it was a small comet, it was up behind Earth, it had a tremendous effect. But here again, K2 is so far out in the solar system that the likelihood of a serious interaction with the inner planets is very remote. And it turns out there are no planetary alignments in the inner solar system at that time, or even with Jupiter. Even though we do have the Jupiter winds that occur, you know, literally on an annual basis, there's still no indication that any of this is going to be augmented or enhanced or amplified or accentuated by the presence of Comet K2. So the only hope that we have, the only hope that is a possibility, is that it'll interact with Jupiter, and in fact that Jupiter, we will see a good light show. And that'll be something that the whole world can see. It's not something you would even need binoculars for. And that's what the ancients talked about. So being that realm of Jupiter, remember that even though Venus is the brightest object in the sky when it's in its elongated position, Jupiter is a very close second. So Jupiter is a very bright object. Having a comet right next to it, visually interacting with it, and a comet that could be potentially much larger visually than Jupiter, would be a potential for some very interesting reactions. And remember, the Colburn is very clear about this, about the sky monsters. In fact, I've always talked about this, and we've seen Venus, what I call go comet, actually turn into a comet. So that's been observed, but it would be really interesting to see Jupiter go comet. The interaction so accentuated that Jupiter itself would, for a brief period of time, turn into a comet. So those are possibilities, but all of this depends on the orbital dynamics, the changes, potential changes of the orbit of Comet K2. Okay. So I'll be talking more about this in the future, and this, of course, is many years out. We're talking about August of 2022, which is, you know, that's 4 years away, essentially. And then April of 2025, that's another 3 years. So this is kind of an interesting thing. So from the time it, according to its current orbital parameters, from the time it crosses the ecliptic and goes down and then comes back is a period of about almost, well, 2.5 years. So this comet is going to be visible. This could break Hale-Bopp's record of being visible to the naked eye in the solar system for a period of about 6 years. Remember that comets typically are visible for a day or two with good equipment for a bit longer, sometimes a week, 2 weeks, a month would be a long time. But 6 years is totally unheard of. Hale-Bopp just broke all the records, and that's because it's in a relatively low orbit. And so that also tells me that there's something hocus, some hocus-pocus going on here with the orbital parameters and the, well, the explanation that this is the first time that this object, K2, has visited our solar system. It's spending so much time in the solar system that I don't believe that it's coming from a distance. Most of those distant comets come and they move through very quickly because they've been falling in towards the sun for their entire orbit. So they zip around the sun and head it back out. But this comet is going to be quite far away from the sun. And therefore, it's going to spend, like I say, from the time it comes in and crosses the ecliptic, it'll be 2.5 years until it goes down below the sun and comes back up and crosses the ecliptic again. 2.5 years. And during that time, it'll probably be visible from the southern hemisphere for that whole period of time. And potentially with the naked eye. And so this could beat all records set by Hale-Bopp. And of course, NASA's plan, they're already lying about the nature of this comet. They're already putting out false scientific information. And that's what they do. That's their business, is providing false information to the public. Okay, so enough of that, but this is a very interesting comet. Too bad we have to wait so long to see this, but such is the world of outer space. Things happen on their own time scale, and there's not a lot we can do about it. But once again, I want to remind you that Comet K2 is not, from all that I can see right now, even if things, I tried to look for optimal orbital changes that would cause it to come closer to the inner planets, and I just don't see it. I just don't see that happening at all. Also, oh, just another little point here, is that Comet K2 will be passing through the asteroid belt. Now, this is something that's very interesting, because Comet K2 has a significant nucleus. And that region out there in the asteroid belt, it's not a belt, it's not a plane or a ring. It's more like a donut shape with the asteroids moving in all directions. But that could disrupt, cause some major disruptions in the asteroid belt and cause a lot of asteroids to be flying around in orbits where they weren't, that they did not have before. So there's a potential for a flurry during that time frame. And of course, NASA is not talking about any of this, because their story is that this is a little teeny snowball comet, and why would it affect the asteroids? Well, that'll be interesting too, because we can actually see these asteroids, and with that, we will be able to determine the mass of the nucleus of this comet. So that's a very interesting point. And there again, it's impossible to make predictions right now. The orbits of the asteroids are fairly well known. There's, you know, tens of thousands of them. But of the thousands of large asteroids and what are known as the Apollo asteroids, they're basically larger, almost planetary size. They're big enough, they're round, they're almost like planets, mini planets. But we can see tens of thousands of asteroids. So if this object starts moving through that region and starts changing the orbits of these asteroids, we'll be able to see that. And by using that data, we could make a very accurate estimate of the mass of the nucleus of comet K2. Remember that when Hale-Bopp came into the solar system, it had a companion. And NASA took that data down immediately because they knew that a very simple formula in celestial mechanics, they knew that you could take that data of the orbital period and the distance from the nucleus, the main nucleus of Hale-Bopp, out to the companion. You could take those two pieces of data, plug it into a very simple formula, and determine the mass of the nucleus. And so they shut that offline, and they never gave any more data that could be used to measure the actual mass of the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. Very interesting. And so, but now we can, with amateur equipment, basically looking at asteroids, fairly good amateur equipment, but basically looking at asteroids, and as this comet passes through the ecliptic, it'll be out in that asteroid region, out beyond Mars, and we'll be able to see the change in the orbits of these asteroids, and by doing that, we can determine the mass of the nucleus of K2 without any assistance from NASA. So that'll be a study that should be coming up, and that's something that just literally everybody can partake in. Anybody that's got a halfway decent equipment. So very interesting. That's all of this. I will be following up on all of this in the future. And I'm not sure if you can hear some background noise here. Where I am right now is raining really, really, really hard. And so there's some noise that actually comes in. I don't know if it can it is picked up on the mic. But if you hear some background noise, that's probably what it is. It sounds like, you know, rain, just a pounding rain. I can hear it here. So, but I'm not sure, like I say, if it comes through on the... On the radio feed. Okay, one last topic. Okay, just a little bit of discussion about water in the world today. And the I of course have a book. It's entitled Water, and it's a very good compilation of how we've gotten to the point where we are today with water. And the control of water, many topics, very interesting, that really everybody should know. It's, for example, ridiculous where you see, say, for example, Hurricane Florence or other disaster areas, the first thing they do is bring in truckloads of bottled water. And, you know, it's a flooded region. All you need is a water filter and you would have clean water for a lot of people. A single water filter could produce the water for a family of 10 or a group of 10 people. And there's plenty of water, it just has to be filtered. And so there's no emergency preparedness going on these days. That's a serious problem. But in general, one of the things I'm trying to work on in the background is solutions to water issues. And if you look at my webpage, I just want to encourage people to go there. And I really recommend more and more that people get the whole house filter. And that is because when you're showering, one of the greatest, you know, cancer just became the number one killer of adults in the United States. And the reason, my belief, is that people are showering with very high chemical concentrations in the water. In that hot, steamy shower, you're breathing it in, and it's hitting your skin, and it's going right into your body, being absorbed into your skin when you take a hot shower. All those chemicals that the municipality puts in the water, it's coming naturally and also just from pollution in the water table. So it's an issue of health. Also, the chlorine that the cities universally or almost universally put in the water, and fluoride are very destructive of your clothes. So when you take your clothes out and there's all that lint there, typically that's the destruction that's occurring because of chlorine and fluoride in your water. Plus, fluoride in your water is one of the most, it's a horrible chemical, what they put in there to keep the bacteria down. And of course, they try and tell you that it's good for your teeth, which, well, you can imagine my opinion of that little gem. But the point is, it's a benefit to get these chemicals out of the water on a whole house basis. And so that's why check out my webpage, the whole house water filters, the MR5 and the MR9. The MR5 is up to 7 gallons a minute, so that's plenty. You'd have 2 people taking a shower and somebody washing clothes, and it could handle that kind of capacity. Or if you have a farm or a ranch or a business, something a bit bigger, then the MR9 would be the appropriate filter. But anyway, check those out. They're on sale. And in general, the water filters and the water filter elements are on sale. So go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and check those out. Because the other thing that does is it helps me with the radio show, pays for the radio show and the webpage. And remember that my webpage is being upgraded right now. It's going to go live probably in the next week or so. And so that all, you know, it costs money to have that that work done. There's a tremendous amount of work to be done there. And it's too complicated for me to do all by myself. So I'm getting some help with that. All of that costs money. So if you're interested in helping me out a little bit, and then you also get products. I don't take donations. I don't ask for donations, etc. I don't have grant money. I don't have government funding, none of that. It's my moral principles don't allow me to take government money because there's always a string attached to it someplace. But anyway, the main source of my support is you out there purchasing water filters and, of course, my books, etc., on the webpage. So go there, jmccsci.com. Check it out, and everybody's back. Kids are in school. Summer vacation is over, and one of the best health things you can do for yourself to have a healthy life for you and your family is to have fresh, clean water. I guess I don't know how else to say it. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. Click on the link for the sales page, and remember, all my archives are there for this show, radio, commercial-free. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.